Hi, I'm Gil Headley, and I'm the proud sponsor of the Anatomy and Movement Channel. Welcome. This conference is important. It's both groundbreaking and ground-building. Literally hundreds of thousands of us have gathered here to expand our experience of embodiment, and in so doing, evolve the embodied experience of our world. Embodiment is a practice that anchors us consciously into that which is common to us all, our human body. Regardless of our differences, and we have them, we all live out our lives in a body, and we're all connected by that shared experience. I've been developing integral anatomy for the past 25 years. I believe the human body is not a problem to be solved, but rather a gift to be received and explored. Integral anatomy is an approach to understanding the whole body, which emphasizes textural layers, continuities, and relationships. We notice differences not to create separation, but to appreciate that which unites us all. I'll be presenting here on the Anatomy and Movement Channel, as well as on the main stage, and I hope you'll join me to explore the heart of inner space. And for further study with me, check out my website, gilheadley.com. When you join my site, you'll automatically receive 3 free full-length courses because I'm on a mission to share what I've learned through my own deep exploration of the human form. And I'm certain that these courses will enhance and transform your own embodiment practice. I hope you enjoy the presentation.
Thank you, Gil. Just quick plug, Gil has a really old and amazing video called The Fuzz that teaches you all about fascia. But today we're going to learn from Mr. Steve James, the Guru Viking. Steve travels internationally teaching somatic practices and meditation, as well as leading explorations in contemplative and relational realms. He is known for his grounded approach and his dedication to firsthand research. He has extensive experience in contemplative and spiritual disciplines, elite athletic performance, the arts, extreme outdoor survival, and human behavior. I'm interested in all of those things, so I'm super stoked to hear from James today. Just a quick note before we get started. This is a webinar style format. If you have any questions, there's a question and answer box. Feel free to populate those throughout the talk and Steve will be fielding them. Otherwise, keep your insights and conversations going in the chat box. So without any interruptions from me, here's Steve James.
Thank you, Kyle. And thank you for having me on the Embodiment Conference. Very exciting. So it's the Embodiment Conference, and I thought it would be fun today to share with you some of the ways in which I like to think about the term embodiment and embodiment practices. And there are lots of different speakers at this conference, loads of different speakers. And you may have noticed as you've listened to them that different speakers have different definitions of embodiment, whether or not those definitions are stated. You can tell by the way that the term is used that there are different emphases and different leanings. And some of those definitions and emphases and leanings are diametrically opposed. Some just chafe a little bit and some are somewhat more consonant. And I think that's actually quite legitimate. Words, especially words like embodiment, can have different meanings in different contexts. For instance, I can put my water on a table or I can table a motion at a meeting. Both of those are valid uses of the word table, but of course they're quite different. And so in this talk, one of the first things I'm going to do is offer you a working definition of embodiment. And I want to emphasize it's not the exclusive, best, highest, most pure definition of embodiment. It's a definition within a sort of possible range of definitions. Okay, so I'm going to share a screen with you here and you will see some stuff. Okay. So what is embodiment? All right. Definition I'm going to offer you today is feeling the sensations of the body. Feeling the sensations of the body. Another way of saying that is feeling the sensations that reveal the presence of the body. What do I mean by that? I mean the way you know you have a body. there's a few different ways we know we have a body. We tend to assume we have a body because it was there the last time we checked. But if you had a kind of Men in Black body mind wipe, and you could no longer had any memory of ever having a body, there would be a cocktail of sensations being generated by the body at that moment that would reveal its presence. And actually feeling those sensations that are being generated by the body at this particular point, that's actually what I'm talking about here when I'm using the word embodiment. So it's actually a rather narrow definition, or you could say specific definition. This talk is called Intimacy with the Body. And so sometimes that word intimacy, I use that in the sense of intimacy with the sensations of the body. And here intimacy is defined as feeling what's there to be felt, feeling what's there to be felt. So once again, it's what sensations is the body generating at this point? What are the sensations that reveal the presence of the body? In that way, this definition is functioning. And then we can also think, if we take that definition as a kind of working model, then we can think of a working definition. Then we could also ask the question, what isn't embodiment? Well, one thing is aiming for a particular set of sensations or optimization of conditions. Often embodiment, the way it's used, and I'm not saying it's not a valid way of using it, but it's just a slightly different way than we're using it here, is a sort of state, a state of wholeness, or a state of feeling kind of at home in the body, or integration, or something like that. But in this definition of embodiment, aiming for a particular set of sensations, optimizing conditions, looking for a feeling of relief, wholeness, or connection, or groundedness, or safety, or any other aspirational state experiences, is outside of the definition of embodiment. There's nothing wrong with feelings of relief or aiming for wholeness and connection, groundedness and safety and so on. Nothing wrong with that at all. But that's a sort of secondary step. The first step is to contact. What sensations is the body generating at this point? It may not be feelings of relief. It may be quite fragmented, in fact, rather than whole. It may feel quite disconnected or ungrounded or maybe under threat. If those are the sensations that the body is generating, then feeling those sensations is just as much embodiment as feeling any of these aspirational state experiences. So I'm not against them. It's just a second step. And if we collapse the feeling what the body is generating with the optimizing or aspirational state experience, if we collapse those into one step, and we say that to be embodied is to feel some variation of good, then we in a certain sense miss an essential essential step here, which is the connecting of what is actually felt in the body currently. Sometimes I say there's no informed consent on intimacy. There's no informed consent on intimacy. And what I mean by that is that you're going to feel when you feel the sensations that your body is generating. You're going to feel what's there to be felt. You're going to feel what's there to be felt. If you feel stressed out, you're going to feel feelings of stress. If you feel freaked out, you're going to feel feelings of freaked out. If you feel whole and connected and grounded and safe, you're going to feel whole sensations of wholeness, connectedness, groundedness, and safety. So embodiment is also not, by this definition, generating loud enough sensations to overcome numbness. And well, what do I mean by that? Let's look at that. Okay. So I like graphs a lot. I have some cool geeky graphs for you in this particular speech. And I wonder if you can remember, now this is somewhat rhetorical because we can't discuss in this format, but I wonder if you can remember how to label the different axes. There are letters that go with these axes. I wonder if you can cast your mind back to school and perhaps you can remember that. I have a cool way of learning it, which I couldn't resist. I have a cool way of remembering it, which I couldn't resist showing you. And this may well be the one thing that you remember from this entire talk. So, okay, how are you going to label these axes? Well, here we have a man or a blue figure of some sort leaping from the y-axis to crash with a kss into the x-axis. So he goes, yikes. That's the way to remember those. Nothing to do with embodiment, I just couldn't resist. Okay, so let's imagine we have our y-axis is volume, our x-axis is time. Let's imagine we're at a KISS concert and the blue line is KISS and the red line is your friend. Yes, even KISS fans have friends, and your friend is talking to you, but the red line is lower than the blue line because the Kiss concert is so loud, Paul Stanley, Gene Simmons, and so on, it's so loud, you can't actually hear what your friend is saying. They're saying something, there's something happening, but you can't hear what they're saying. So what are your options? Well, what you might do at a concert is your friend might get real close to you and shout in your ear and punch through momentarily the level of volume that Kiss is generating, and then you will indeed be able to hear what they're saying. But there's a problem with that particular strategy. It works in the short term, but it's not such a good long-term strategy. Generating loud sensations to punch through the Kiss concert, or in the case of embodiment, generating through perhaps very strong physical practices, loud or strong sensation to punch through numbness, to punch through the sort of layer of stress or whatever the case may be, so you can feel something as an embodiment strategy. Well, it'll work, you'll feel something, but in the long term, what happens at the Kiss concert? Your voice gets, your throat gets hoarse, your voice gets tired, and so on and so forth. And similarly, you can redline your body and wear it out in doing that sort of an approach. So what are your other options? Well, it's possible to start, if you leave the Kiss concert somehow or another, and you end up, say, I don't know, you go from this Kiss concert to the next best place you could possibly be in the world, a library. And now suddenly what your friend was saying to you the entire time becomes detectable. The friend was saying it the entire time, but when the ambient noise level of the Kiss concert is lowered, the friend's message, if you want, what they're saying to you can be detected. So in this case, as a general strategy, finding ways to lower the ambient noise level, to tune in to the sensations that the body is generating, as opposed to ramping them up, is, I think, a smart move. So here's a model that I learned from my meditation teacher, Shinzen Young, who's an American meditation teacher, Shinzen Young, author of The Science of Enlightenment. He has this concept of sensory clarity, and he divides it into two sections, magnification and resolution. Magnification, there's a magnifying glass. Magnification is seeing, if you want, things that are so small that you can't detect them. When you use magnification, suddenly what was already there but beneath the level of detection becomes detectable. And we can contrast that. So it means, in a certain sense, detecting more of what's available to detect. And resolution, here's a television screen. We could think of resolution like a TV screen or YouTube video. If you have a low resolution, the image is very pixelated and quite difficult to make out the details of the faces and so on. In a high resolution situation, you can tell everything. You can see the glorious mustache hairs on there, and you can see every little pore and so on and so forth. So resolution is to do with the distinctions that we make with the data that's flowing in. If you think about the example of a wine taster. Now, when I drink wine, it has been alleged, I just sort of throw it down me and that's the end of the story. So it's been alleged. But if I'm sitting next to a wine taster and we drink, both of us, the same wine, the same data is flowing in through the senses of the wine, but the wine taster has a high degree of sensory clarity. They're able to detect certain things in the flavor that perhaps I wouldn't even notice. That's magnification. They're able to distinguish those flavors and those sensations in fine detail. They can see, oh yes, this was a wine made in June next to an oak tree. The squirrel was reading Shakespeare in a nearby field. They can detect all of this stuff. How is that the case? Because they have a high degree of sensory clarity. And it's very similar for embodiment. As we become more embodied, we begin to detect things that previously were always there, but we were not able to detect. And similarly, we're able to make finer and finer distinctions with the information that we're able to detect. So we might ask the question, when are we embodied? And here's another cool graph. Y-axis embodiment, x-axis is time. And this blue line is your level of embodiment at that moment. And let's say you engage in an embodiment practice, and we'll define what that is later, actually. Let's say you engage in an embodiment practice of some sort. You'll have a temporary increase in embodiment. If you deliberately pay attention to the sensations your body is generating through some sort of embodiment practice, whether it's a meditation practice or a movement practice or whatever is the case, you'll have a temporary spike or increase in your embodiment level. But then you leave that class, or you leave that, you stop that practice, you go about the rest of your day. And generally, what happens is that level of embodiment falls and returns to your baseline. Your baseline of embodiment is how embodied you are when you're not trying to be embodied, just sort of walking around level of embodiment. And then if you practice again, once again, you have an increase followed by return to the baseline, and another temporary increase followed by return to the baseline. But if you keep practicing regularly, keep turning your attention towards the sensations that the body is generating, something interesting can happen. There can be a general improvement or increase in your baseline of embodiment. That's how embodied you are when you're not trying to be embodied. So over time, when the short term, we see a temporary increase in embodiment when we engage in embodiment practices, followed by a falling back to the baseline. Regular practice tends to see an increase in your baseline of embodiment. You still get the ups and downs, of course, but the general baseline, your general ability to detect and to differentiate what you detect improves. So successful application of embodiment techniques tends to improve embodiment during the practice session, as well as improve one's baseline embodiment over time. So we could consider why we might want to be embodied. We consider what would be the benefits of that. And I would perhaps ask you that if we were in person, and ask you, because actually there are many interesting reasons, and it never ceases to surprise me the sorts of very good but quite unexpected reasons people are engaging in embodiment practices. So perhaps as I'm going through this list, you could also think, why do you engage in embodiment practices if you do? Why are you interested in embodiment? There's a reason. You may not have articulated the reason before, but it's in there. So it's very interesting generally to figure out, well, why am I actually doing this? That can help guide your technique selection. It can help guide the way in which you engage with the topic and the sorts of practices that you take on and so on. So it's actually very useful to tune into that idea of why. But here are some general good reasons that people tend to have. Well, you get increased sensory clarity. As I said before, more data and finer distinctions. And that can produce a kind of enhance a sort of richness of life. There's something about drinking a glass of wine. A Philistine like me drinks it and enjoy it. It's wine, it's nice and all that. But wow, if a wine taster, when they drink a really nice glass of wine, they have much, much deeper appreciation, you could argue. Or somebody is very nice to listen to symphony being played. But if you have a trained ear, a refined ear, and you really know how to pick out the subtleties of the musicians and the orchestra and the arrangements and all this sort of thing, then you can have a much richer, you might argue, experience of that symphony. And there's something to be said for that. Life is very much about what we experience and can detect. And so an increase in our sensory clarity in that area can be beneficial. Also, embodiment can give insight into oneself and others. Insight into oneself and others. As you pay attention to the sensations your body generates, you're going to notice a few things. You're going to learn a few things. You're going to learn on very superficial levels, and even perhaps quite deep levels, the way in which the body-mind system, and yours in particular, functions. It may be a superficial insight like, oh, if I'm on Facebook for 10 hours a day, I feel stressed, something like that. So it could be quite superficial like that, or it could be something very, very, very much more profound and deep. But actually, even a superficial insight like being on Facebook a lot causes me anxiety or stress, something fairly superficial like that, it's a significant insight. It takes some people, very difficult to understand what triggers states in the body. What made me feel bad? Why did I feel this way? When did it start? For instance, in terms of boundary setting, very often people don't realize they're not okay with something until maybe hours, days afterwards, walking down the street and suddenly think, oh, that's why I feel bad. There's a delayed realization, if you want, as to what's affecting our states, our moods, and our sensations. So it's actually very useful and quite valuable, even a sort of superficial insight, such as how much Facebook time affects your mood or something like that. Quite useful indeed. And we can expect, as one becomes more embodied, that insight into yourself and therefore others, because we're not so different after all, can occur. Also, it's possible to have somewhat better navigation as one becomes more embodied. I like to think of this as bringing your body to your board of advisors. If you imagine inside of you, there's a sort of round table, King Arthur's round table kind of thing. And there's different characters there. Maybe there's your memories, there's your cultural conditioning, there's your sort of conscious mind. There's all different sorts of component parts of you that are coming together. And if you bring your body to that board of advisors, then when decisions are made, when assessments are made of situations, you have a valuable voice on that council, which is your body being brought to the board of advisors. Because it turns out the body has all kinds of interesting reactions, responses, and data points to contribute. Now, there can be, admittedly, an interesting developmental stage where people who have previously not been very in touch with their body sensations begin to become more embodied. There can be a dictatorship of the body. The body, in a certain sense, having not been listened to very much, can take center stage in a somewhat dictatorial way. And you see sort of people can't get out of bed without their green juice and so on, and they don't do anything unless it's 100% yes in the body, and this sort of idea. I mean, it's a nice idea, but I think, and it's an understandable developmental stage, but I think it is a developmental stage. After all, it's good sometimes to be able to, sometimes it's really useful to be able to override the body. Sometimes it's really useful to be able to override the body. For instance, if you need to get up in the morning and you don't feel like getting up, that might be a good time to override the body. Or you have a deadline the next day and you need to work for another half an hour or hour or 2 hours or something like that to get it done. Sometimes in that situation, maybe it's a good idea to override the body. But if you override the body and your body is on the board of advisors, at least you know what the body is saying. At least you know what you're overriding. At least you're, in a certain sense, in touch with those sensations that are going forward. So that can help to optimize your decision-making, and you can have a better informed pleasure-pain calculation. And I think that's not something we have time to talk about. If you'd like to know about pleasure-pain calculation, you can ask me in the Q&A, but I think we'll skip that for now. There's some secondary reasons why it's good to be more embodied. Certainly, you could say you get a bit more concentration. Most embodiment practices involve a kind of tuning in or feeling the sensations of the body. And there's a certain sense in which if one is practicing embodiment of any sort, generally, one's going to improve one's concentration, one's ability to pay attention to what one deems relevant, in this case, the body sensations. So there'll be an increase generally in a certain degree of concentration, and also perhaps equanimity. When one gets more and more to know the sensations of the body, one of the lessons that one tends to acquire, or one of the skills one tends to develop, is this skill of equanimity, an ability to be with sensations without push or pull, an ability to, in a certain sense, be, let's put it this way, to feel bad, to feel good, to feel whatever your body's feeling, actually. Equanimity is that sort of, you get used to those sorts of, the range of emotions and feelings that are possible in the body. You become more acquainted with them and more capable of feeling them, or of holding them, or of navigating them, or of being with them, less prone to bounce off of them into distracting behavior or numbing behavior and so on. So these are some secondary benefits, I think, of embodiment, secondary to the sensory clarity benefits that we listed before. So you might wonder, in what way do we become more embodied, or how do we become more embodied? And quite simply, by feeling the sensations that reveal the presence of the body, by feeling the sensations that reveal the presence of the body. I like to make a distinction between embodiment and embodying practices, embodiment and embodying practices. Embodiment practice is a practice in which its primary aim is embodiment, is to sensitize one to the sensations that the body is generating. An embodying practice is a practice that its primary aim is something else, but it may have a secondary benefit of improving your embodiment, of getting you in touch with the sensations that reveal the presence of your body. For instance, I can think of an example of such as strength training. If you're doing strength training, what's the primary aim of a strength training activity? Well, it's to improve your strength, of course. But secondarily, it may well have the benefit of getting you better in touch with the sensations that reveal the presence of your body. So I'd like to make that distinction. There are lots of worthwhile activities that one can engage with, in the body, that are not primarily about embodiment. So that's a distinction here. But the key here, if we're talking about embodiment practices, how to improve embodiment, it really is quite simple, actually, by this definition, feeling the sensations that reveal the presence of the body. So if you're meditating and you want to do meditation to improve your embodiment, just feel the sensations that the body is generating. That will improve your embodiment. If you're doing a yoga practice and you want it to be a sort of embodiment oriented or primarily an embodiment oriented practice, then feel the sensations that reveal the presence of the body. Let those be your guide. Let those be your emphasis, as opposed to, say, shape making, for example, getting into certain sorts of poses or postures, or attempting to reach a state of calm or tranquility or something of that nature. Nothing wrong with trying to get into cool poses. Nothing wrong with trying to get into states of calm and tranquility. But they're a sort of second step. First step, contacting the sensations the body is generating. Of course, what you do with the sensations when you find them, it's open season there. You can go in any direction you like. So those are some thoughts on embodiment. And I thought I'd share with you some of the way in which I look at that term. And I see there's lots of chat. So if there are any questions, I can take some questions now. Looking here. Okay. What I thought were questions were actually people just saying where they're coming from. That's right. In that case, let's do some embodiment. Mm-hmm. Style things. Okay. So we do a little bit of a meditation, I think. So you can get yourself in your meditation position. If you have a special position you like, you can get into that, or just be wherever you are. All right, and your eyes could be open or closed for this. But for a moment, feel the sensations that reveal the presence of your body. And we'll meditate here for maybe 5 minutes or so. And I'm going to show you some interesting distinctions from a meditation point of view about embodiment here in this guided meditation. So feeling the sensations that reveal the presence of your body. Feeling the sensations that reveal the presence of your body. Perhaps you can feel your bottom on the chair, your hands in your lap, or your clothing on your skin. And there's two things happening here. On the one hand, there's the raw sensory data revealing the presence of your body. And on the other hand, there's the mind labeling. That's my bottom on the chair. That's my clothing on my skin. Those are my hands in my lap. and see if it's possible, even as the mind labels and categorizes. You don't have to stop it from doing that. See if it's possible to also tune in to the raw sensory data flowing in, revealing the presence of your body before it becomes bottom on cushion, clothing on skin, or hands on lap. We tend to assume the body is there because it was there the last time we checked. But if you knew nothing about bodies and bottoms on chairs and hands and lap and clothing on skin, what can you actually feel? Good. I know many people watching are meditators, and indeed there are some meditation teachers. So I'm going to offer you another set of distinctions that I learned from my meditation teacher, Shinzen Young. And when you're tuning into the sensations that reveal the presence of the body, you have a few different options: global, local, or free floating. Global, local, or free floating. Global, whole body at once. Local, a deliberate directing of your attention to something that's less than the whole. So for instance, perhaps you can feel itchiness in your nose or a contact your hands have with your lap. You can hone in on a local area like that. Local also includes body scanning. Deliberately directing the attention, say, as is often done, from the top of the head to the bottom of the feet, or from the center to the periphery. That's local, a deliberate directing of the attention to less than the whole. And then free floating. In free floating, one allows the attention to move around as it does, not deliberately directing it. Perhaps it goes from the knee to the shoulder, to the chest, wherever the attention lands, you soak in. But you don't deliberately direct it. So long as it stays within the focus range of the body, it's fair game. So let's first of all begin with a global focus range. Global focus range. Whole body at once. If you notice you get drawn into a particular part of the body at the exclusion of the rest, then when you notice that's happened, reestablishing a global focus range option, whole body at once. Good, let's switch to local. In this case, choosing one particular place in the body and tuning in on that place, one particular set of sensations, tuning in to those set of sensations. It could be the strongest sensations that are being generated For instance, if you have pain or stiffness, that might be a natural choice, but it needn't be. It could also be an area of where there's relatively less sensations. Very often we're drawn, especially if it's pain, to the pain. It's a useful skill to also be able to tune into other parts of the body that are less loud, relatively more restful, or relatively less active. So whether you choose an area of strong sensation or a relatively restful area, pick something. Local focus option. You may be aware of sights, sounds, thoughts, or other body sensations. And that's fine. If you're aware of sights, sounds, thoughts, or other body sensations, just let them go on in the background. Attending to the area of local focus that you've chosen. And if you find you've been drawn away by sights, sounds, thoughts, or other body sensations, when you notice you've been drawn away, returning to the local focus range that you've selected. Good. And let's try free floating, free floating. And here, it doesn't make a deliberate attempt to restrict or direct the attention, so long as it remains within the focus range of the body sensations. So perhaps it's on your knee for a few seconds, then it goes to your shoulder, then your face, then your chest. Allowing it to move as it does. It may linger or stay in one place, also fine. Wherever it lands, soak the attention into that place. Soaking the attention into the sensations that you detect. an interesting option here is labels. A label is a word either spoken out loud or in your mind that can support the technique. So in this case, because we're working with feeling the body sensations, the label is feel, feel. And what happens is your attention, say, lands on the knee, you soak the attention into the sensations, and then you say out loud or in your mind's eye, feel, feel, like that, in an even, calm voice. And the label can function a little bit like the thumb of a masseuse, transferring the force of the stroke into the muscle. It can be the case that a label can transfer or help to transfer the attention into the sensation. It's optional. Detect the sensation, soak the attention in, and then the label is feel, either out loud or in your mind's eye, in your mind's ear. Okay, good. If your eyes are closed, you can open them again. So we were feeling the sensations that the body was generating there, and we work globally, whole body at once, local or free floating. Now, I see a question here. What do I mean by pleasure pain calculation? Well, pleasure pain calculation, what I mean by that is it seems it's the momentum of the organism to optimize its conditions. And we seem to have sort of inside of us a kind of pleasure pain calculation. We generally instinctively tend to go towards good things and away from bad things. But our pleasure pain calculation is a little bit, as I think we probably know if you think about it, it's not an absolute science. There's a few reasons why that is. We don't have all the information. When we make a decision, we go perhaps generally with what we think is the right thing to do and away from what we think is the wrong thing to do, but we don't have all the data points. We don't know how things are going to turn out. So when I say that increasing your embodiment, improving your embodiment can help your pleasure pain calculation, is because we have more data points to feed into it. We have a better sense of the body's, if you want, view or the body's data points on the decision, bringing the body to the table of advisors. There's another factor that affects the pleasure pain calculation, which is the temporal dimension across time. What feels good now may not feel good tomorrow. When you have the 700th Pringle, feels really good now, maybe. But will it feel good tomorrow? So there's this interesting tension also but along the temporal or time dimension as well. So that's the plain pressure calculation. I think it's the momentum of the organism to optimize its conditions, seems to be. Just the same way the plant reaches towards the sun. We're in many ways driven, you could say, by this pleasure pain calculation. Even when we are... even when we choose to embrace pain, even when we choose to embrace a negative situation, you could argue that it's a high level negotiation with life or with the situation, hoping that if I willfully or deliberately embrace pain or difficulty now, then later on, I will be better able to handle pain and difficulty. So it's a certain sense a kicking the can down the road, and not an intelligent one necessarily, but that force is always there. So when we increase our sensory clarity, we're getting more data points and we're making finer and finer distinction. That's magnification and resolution. That feeds into that pleasure pain calculation and can give it a slightly different hue. Other things that can affect our pleasure pain calculation are things like trauma, you know, or any experience of the past. If you're very used to things being a certain way, you're going to expect them to be that way in the future. And if you've had traumatic experiences, you may be quite averse to certain situations and certain, may in other words, affect the way in which you perceive situations and navigate them, the way in which you calculate risk, et cetera, et cetera. So lots of complicated factors that go into that pleasure pain calculation, but certainly the sense, being in touch with the sensations of the body can help that. Let's see what else we've got here. Adelia is saying, with the global body focus, could you explain a little more about how that can work? I found myself moving to the periphery of my body awareness and then sensing into that space. But at times it felt like I could also be starting from the center and sensing outward. In that sense, I was unable to hold the global sense statically, but it felt more like flow. That's very interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think there's an interesting point you've raised here, and I'm going to take it in this way. From where are you doing the detecting? From where are you doing the detecting? That's actually a very interesting question. For instance, most of us feel that we're somewhere behind the eyes. Some people, I understand, feel that they're somewhere in the chest or the throat even. I've heard people say that before. So there's a sense of one's perceiving from a certain vantage point. So if you feel the whole body at once, you might imagine yourself here perceiving out into the body from some sort of center out to periphery. I think that's quite a reasonable way to operate. How to access, but it could be argued also that that sense of where one's arguing from is itself a set of sensations. Can you also, a set of body sensations perhaps, what about that cluster of tension behind the eyes? What about that sense of a platform in the chest that one is viewing from? What if one was to include that also in the range of sensations that are available for detection? That's an interesting meditative exploration. Generally, that sort of thing is called self-inquiry. One's inquiring into the sense of oneself, the sense of, in my case, Steve, or in your case, Adelia. And there's a somatic or physical component to that sense as well. What are the physical locations or location of my sense of myself? Is there a body sensation, a knot of tension, a subtle sense of a platform that can be detected bodily? Of course, there's also the mental inner auditory and inner visual constructions that contribute to that. But what are, if we're talking about embodiment and we're looking specifically at the body sensations, are there body sensations that feel like the place from which we're looking? It's interesting. And as for the rest of your question, there, you know, how do you approach a global body focus? Sure, one way to do it, because naturally, of course, we tend to be drawn to a point. We tend to be drawn to something that is drawing our attention. If there's pain, then in the body, for instance, in the knee, let's say, you're drawn to that pain in the knee. It nags on you, it pulls you. That's part of pain's job, is to alert you to something and then look at me. And so if you're going to go from that normal way of doing things to a global, then there's a sense of opening up. There's a sense of opening up to get to the global. Or maybe, as Adelia says, you feel the edges first and then you relax, feeling the edges, which is a form of local focus. You're feeling the edges, the periphery. Then from there, you can open up to feel the whole body that's shaded in between. It's a little bit like looking at a painting. If you look at a painting globally, you may have a diffused gaze and you just drink in the entire painting. If you look at a painting locally, you might choose to look at that one character in the Night's Watch, or you look at that, you know, that halberd or that helmet, or that face poking out there. Or you might choose in a local focus, because remember, local is deliberately directing the attention. You might decide to scan the painting. So scan it in a systematic way, line by line, or maybe diagonally, or maybe you go from center to periphery and periphery to center. There's many different ways you can scan. So you decide to do it like that. If you're doing free floating, you look at the painting, and wherever your attention goes, you let it go there. So long as it's within the painting, it's fair game. And wherever it lands, though, you soak in. So when you land on that halberd, I'm thinking of the Night Watch in Amsterdam and the Rijksmuseum, which is quite a stunning painting. Then you look at that halberd. Oh, you soak into that halberd, really paying attention, drinking it in. Oh, then you go to the helmet, look at the helmet. Then you look at that face, soaking into the face. If you were to use the label, remember we said that with free floating, there's a possibility of using a label to aid in the directing of the attention. Then you might say see. See would be the label that we use for visual sensation. So you look at the halberd, you detect it, you soak in, then you say see, either out loud or in your mind's eye. If you're in the museum, probably better to say in your mind's eye, if you want to stay in the museum and not get thrown out. And then you look at the helmet, see. You look at the face, detect the face, soak into the face, see. That's the process there. Catalina is saying, oh yeah, there's a couple of questions on the same line. I'm going to read several of them out. How do you help people with their resistance to feeling their body if it's in pain or negative belief, i.e. my body part's not okay? Kathy says that. And then Catalina says, how to work embodiment with people who have trauma in their bodies and are disconnected from their bodies. Those are sort of related questions. Yeah. You know, we talked about some good reasons to be more embodied, but there are actually good reasons not to be as well. Or rather, let's put it this way. There are reasons why people are not more embodied. And they're not all, you know, bad reasons. One of the reasons people don't feel more is because it hurts. When they feel that breach the, you know, the threshold and start to feel the sensations that the body is generating, it hurts. Could be physical pain, could be emotional pain and so on. And that can be the case. So it's another reason why this sort of KISS concert analogy of punching through the KISS concert to feel something, this sort of aggressive practices of getting one in touch with the sensations of someone's body. Yeah, it works, but it's a little bit high risk. If you plunge someone with trauma or someone with a lot of stored pain in the body like that into their body, the bodily sensation, it can be quite unproductive, perhaps even re-traumatizing. So how to work with embodiment with people who have trauma in their bodies and are disconnected from their bodies or have resistance to feeling their bodies? I think the answer is gently. And remember that if you feel resistance in your body, that is a sensation set. Embodiment is not necessarily, in this definition, the definition is feeling the sensations that the body is generating. So if someone is doing that, and they say, I feel resistance, or I feel aversion, or I feel like numbness, that's fine. Feel numbness. If you feel resistance, feel the resistance. If you feel aversion, feel the aversion. You don't have to go any further than that, actually. And of course, if people have trauma of complex nature, or then these sorts of things ought to be worked out with a trauma therapist. Just feeling the sensations of the body can be, you know, can be very healing, actually. It can be very nourishing, but not necessarily. It's possible that it needs oversight, or say supervision, with the sorts of specialist tools that a trauma therapist can offer. So assuming that is in place, my particular, if you want, take on it, or my particular way of working with it, is not to push, gently, and to allow for sensations of numbness and a relative absence of sensation. That's all fair game, and not to prefer, say, you know, wholeness or connectedness or safety or something like that, from an embodiment, from contacting the sensations of the body point of view. And some more things here. Is it normal to feel a bit aroused, Rob is saying, when doing body scans, embodiment techniques, etc., and why? Mm-hmm. Oh, it's 55 past. Rob, yes, it is, I think. And that's because, oh, it's nice. Is it normal to feel aroused? Well, it's normal to feel all sorts of things. There's no informed consent on intimacy. When you feel the sensations that the body is generating, you're going to feel what's there to be felt. If there's arousal and pleasure and bliss, you'll feel that. If there's something else, you'll feel that as well. I'm afraid I have to stop here, everybody. Thank you very much for these tremendous questions and for listening. My pleasure. Now, I think this is where Kyle comes in.
Yeah, thank you so much, Steve. Some quick closing things. So one, what is the takeaway you want people to walk away with this talk remembering? Like, what is something, accessible for folks to take away from this talk?
I think that embodiment is feeling the sensations that reveal the presence of the body, a wonderful step, an important step. And that even though one may be hoping for safety, security, groundedness, a feeling of wholeness, that is a second step, not to override any feelings that are contrary to that, to contact them and learn to do that. So I'd say something like that.
I think what I'm taking away is like you really gave me permission to feel all the things, to let them come in. And then also, especially with the graph, showing me how I can, by paying attention to that, I can increase my overall awareness and start to create a connection with those feelings and see where they're coming from or maybe where I want to go with them. That's something that I took away from this
experience. That was a far better takeaway than mine. So yeah, I like that takeaway.
And then where can people find you? So if you want to both say it and populate it in the chat, but I know Steve James is the Guru Viking on Instagram. And yeah, how can people get in contact with you? How can people connect with you after this talk?
Yeah, www.guruviking.com. That's the place to find me. Also Guru Viking on Instagram, Guru Viking on Facebook and so on. On November 1st, we're starting a month-long Get a Daily Practice Challenge where we teach you how to build a daily practice. It's a free course with lectures and guided meditations in a Facebook group. That's the next sort of cool thing that's happening. GuruViking.com, Guru Viking podcast. We have something like 70 episodes of that. So those are the places to find me.
Awesome. So if you like this talk, still you can watch this for the next 48 hours on Facebook Live. You can also purchase this talk as well as all of the other bonuses, amazing speakers, presentation. This meditation alone is probably worth it to just tune in and check in with yourself and get Steve's kind of live voice to guide you here. So go ahead and purchase if you haven't yet. And final tip from the Guru Viking, final tip, how to stay embodied.
Feel.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Lots of good stuff coming in the chats. Brilliant, Steve. Thank you so much. Going to follow up with you. Have a lovely weekend. Thanks again to our tech host, Leanna, making sure everything going smoothly. Thanks to all of you joining on the replay. Stay embodied, get outside, and feel. All right, that's all we got today. Take care, people.